on June the 21st, 1940.
And is that where you grew up in Lakeland?
Actually, no. We lived there a year or two, and then my parents moved to Williamsburg, Virginia, and they were there for probably 2 years. My sister was born in Williamsburg, and then we moved back to Leesburg, Florida, and I grew up in Leesburg, went to school there.
And where is Leesburg?
Leesburg is between Orlando and Ocala, on Highway 27 and 441.
Okay. Can you tell me something about your parents and siblings?
My mother was a nurse, and my father was a citrus broker. And I had one brother and one sister, both of whom are younger than me. My sister's 2 years younger, and my brother was 7 years younger. And he died in 1998 of a heart attack.
And what is a citrus broker?
What's a citrus broker?
Mm-hmm.
They buy and sell fruit.
Oh, okay.
And so he, you know, would buy oranges and grapefruit and whatever, and then in the summer, watermelons and peaches. And,
okay. Mm-hmm. And your mom, you say she was a nurse?
She's a nurse.
Okay.
And she graduated from the same nursing school that I went to.
Mm-hmm.
She graduated in 1939. And I graduated in 1961, but she didn't work until 1949, and then she worked as a nurse until she was 65 years mm-hmm. old.
And what was her specialty?
Well, she did administration for a while, was the director of nursing at the small hospital in Leesburg, Young's Community Hospital, I guess that's what the name of it was. And then she worked 20 years in a doctor's office. And then she went down to Belgrade, Florida when she was about 60 and worked down there in a general hospital just on a medical surgical unit until she retired.
Mm-hmm.
Well, no, for about 3 years. And then she moved back and worked in the Lake Community Hospital for mm-hmm. a couple of years.
Now, did her being a nurse have any influence on your choice of careers?
Well, she, yes, as a matter of fact. She wanted me to be a nurse, and I did not know what I wanted to be.
Uh-huh.
My high school math teacher wanted me to be a math person,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't really know. I was fairly insecure as a teenager and didn't really know what I wanted. So I said to Mother, when she told me she wanted me to go to nursing school, she thought I'd be good at that. Well, if I go there and I don't like it, I can quit after 6 months, right? And she said, right. So I went to nursing school, and of course I liked it,
mm-hmm.
and I've been in it since 1958.
Mm-hmm. That's a good long time. And what about, you just mentioned that you liked math in high school, so that must have been your favorite subject, I guess.
Well, no, history was my favorite subject, but I was good in math and science, except for physics.
Mm-hmm.
And the physics professor didn't like girls in his class, and so he talked dirty and embarrassed us and did all kinds of stuff, and so I think all of us dropped out of his class and took something else.
So after you graduated from high school, that's when you decided to go into nursing school?
Well, then I went directly after the summer, went
mm-hmm.
to nursing school,
mm-hmm.
starting in September of 1958. And graduated from there in August of 1961. I went to Orange Memorial Hospital School of Nursing in Orlando, Florida.
And what was it like being in nursing school in those days, in the late 50s and early 60s?
Well, I don't exactly know how to explain it. It was, of course, I didn't know what to expect.
Mm-hmm.
We had classes. The first 6 months we mostly had classes and, you know, some skills classes. We were busy 40 hours a week doing something and lived in a dormitory and ate in the hospital cafeteria. And of course, I didn't have any money or a car. And the first year we were there, none of us could have a car, I don't think. But after that, a few people had cars, so we got around town on the weekends. And after the 6 months, then we were working on the units, and we had our class schedule integrated with our work schedule, but we also worked some evening shifts.
Mm-hmm.
And then as the years progressed, we covered all the shifts.
Mm-hmm.
So we were busy 40 hours a week, and you know, some of us were always working weekends. Mm-hmm. We had different kinds of schedules.
Mm-hmm. And who ran the hospital? It wasn't affiliated with a sisters, or what was it, community hospital?
It was a, I guess a county hospital, Orange County, Florida. And of course they had the usual contingent of administrators.
Right.
And the nursing school was separate from the administration of the hospital. So we had our own director of nursing,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
instructional staff and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But when we were on the units, we interacted a lot with the head nurses and the supervisors there, because they, of course, were in charge of us.
Mm-hmm. Right. I imagine eventually you did rotations in the various units of the hospital.
We did. We were on all the surgical units, the medical units, the obstetrical units. We had rotations through the operating room. And in 1958, all the hospitals in Florida were still segregated.
Mm-hmm.
So. From time to time, we'd rotate through the black units, and then we'd be on the white units. And we affiliated for psychiatry at DePaul Hospital in New Orleans, and for pediatrics at Charity Hospital in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
And Charity Hospital had 1,000 beds. Not all of it was pediatrics, but about, you know, they had about 200 or 300 pediatric patients.
Mm-hmm.
And one side was white and one side was black. And I was assigned on the black side,
mm-hmm.
which was fine. And they had two medical schools that rotated through there, University of Louisiana and Tulane and LSU. And so every other night, those residents and students would be in charge, and we worked
mm-hmm.
with them.
Mm-hmm. So how long did you stay in New Orleans?
6 months.
6 months.
Mm-hmm.
Did you enjoy it?
I loved it. We were there from January to June, and so it was cold, and then we got into the rainy season, but we were there for Mardi Gras, and certainly on Saturday nights, we were usually down in the French Quarter.
I assume it was a 3-year program, is that correct?
Correct.
And did you receive a diploma afterwards, or a BS in nursing?
A diploma.
Diploma.
And after the diploma, one of my classmates' mothers was a director of nursing at a county hospital in Bradenton, Florida. And she offered as many of us as wanted jobs, a job. And again, I had no real issue.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, sure, I'll go down there and work. So I did. And worked in Bradenton at Manatee Memorial Hospital for a year. In the emergency room is where I got assigned. And I had no clue that I wanted to do emergency room nursing, but I worked there a year. And in 1961, I was the only person in this emergency room.
No doctors?
No doctors assigned. There was one doctor on call. And then if the patients came in, if you had a family doctor, that's who I would call. To see what, you know, to come see you. And it was, you know, we had a couple of famous doctors. One, Dr. Smith, who helped with the development of the Smith POTS or the Blaylock-Smith pediatric surgical procedure, heart surgery. And he didn't like being called at home, and so he would come by if he was on call and say, now honey, if you don't call me, I'll send you chocolates tomorrow. And I'd say, I can't promise that, but if nobody came in that didn't have a doctor, you know. So one time he sent this 5-pound box of chocolate down there, which I didn't deserve, because I would have called him. Anyway, it was fun, but scary.
I can imagine. That's a lot of responsibility for one person.
For a new graduate, we had one really surgical kind of table. So we did all of our suturing and cast and things in that room. And we had four little medical beds on one side, and then we had these two other little rooms that we could stick people if we had to. But whoever would come in, I'd have to do the history and, you know, call the doctor, do the vital signs. Then I had to clean up after they left. I had to change the linens. I had to clean the instruments if we sewed them up and sterilize them. And they don't have to do any of that now. And if some big thing came in, like an automobile accident, I'd have to call the supervisor to come help me because I was overwhelmed. And after a couple of months, they wanted me to collect the money too. And I said, no. So they built a little box outside the emergency room for the person to collect the money. I said, I am not collecting the money.
That's just unbelievable.
I learned a lot.
I can imagine so. Mm-hmm. So what was your next, where'd you go next after that?
Well, next I went to the University of Florida and worked on my bachelor's degree in nursing.
And did that take you 4 years since you already had a lot of experience in nursing? And
at the University of Florida, at the time I went, they were on a trimester system. And so it took me 5 trimesters. I started in August of 62 and graduated in April of 64. Mm-hmm. But let me tell you one other funny story about the ER.
Okay.
You know, these doctors don't like to be called. This woman came in on Sunday night between 9 and 10 o'clock, and it's really kind of slow. And she had a little bit of a headache, but all of her vital signs were good, and there was nothing obviously wrong with her. But when I looked in her eyes, she wasn't exactly there, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. She was kind of vacant. So I called the doctor, and he said, well, what do you want me to do about it? I said, well, if you're not going to come see her, I think you need to admit her to the hospital. And in 1962, you could do that because insurance wasn't the bugaboo that it is now. So we admitted her. And by 3 a.m., she was on a respirator. She had encephalitis. And, you know, she lived in a trailer by herself, which was what made me reluctant to send her home. But I couldn't pinpoint anything that was going on except that she had a little vacancy in her eyes.
So if you had not taken care of her, what would have happened?
Well, she'd have died. Oh, no. She'd have stopped breathing.
Mm-hmm. That is amazing. Oh.
So anyway, then in August of 62, I moved up to Gainesville to go to the university. And did that for 5 trimesters, worked over the summer, and then started my master's program. They had just gotten approval for a master's program, and they were recruiting students. And so I said, sure. I mean, I always made good grades, and so I was an attractive candidate. I graduated with honors from the university.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you... You did nothing but schooling during that period of time.
Well, that's not exactly true. The first... 6 months I was there, from September to about February, mm-hmm. I was the night supervisor in the student infirmary. And I worked every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night from midnight until 8 a.m. And I had classes on Monday all day, and I just about died before I got through the end of that day. And the reason I was the night supervisor, because I was still a relatively new graduate, mm-hmm. the other nurse was a black nurse, and so she couldn't be the supervisor, which I thought was very unfair. Anyway, after 6 months, I got several scholarships, and so I was able to quit working and only study for the next 4 trimesters, which was a luxury.
Did you say, did you get any scholarships to help you with the financing? Or
yes.
Go to school?
Well, when I started, the tuition was only $93 a semester. And so all I needed was rent money and food money and mm-hmm. stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I earned that by working 3 nights a week. Mm-hmm. And after that, then I got a scholarship, you know, a state scholarship, mm-hmm. and that paid all my expenses.
Oh, great.
Mm-hmm.
And so after you got your master's degree, what was your next adventure?
Well, the scholarship I was talking about was still for the bachelor's.
Oh, the bachelor's, okay.
Right. And then I worked the summer on a specialty unit at Chan's mm-hmm. Teaching Hospital
mm-hmm.
and then started my master's. And I got, they had educational traineeships then. And so I had a traineeship, and I also was a graduate assistant and helped teach public health. And I was making more money going to school for my master's degree than I'd ever made so far working full-time. So after I did that, got my master's degree, that took three trimesters.
Mm-hmm.
So I graduated from there in August of 65. And I worked for 2 or 3 months as a research assistant for somebody that was doing some research. And then I got offered a position as, they called them a nurse two, which was a supervisor. And so I was responsible for the general surgical unit. And we had 42 patients and 28 staff. And at the University of Florida then, we had 24-hour responsibility. And we didn't have any supervisors on any other shifts, just, you know, one person.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that for 4 years, I guess. 3 or 4 years.
And I know you got your PhD later on. When did you receive that, by any chance? Do you recall what year that was?
Oh, I finished in 78.
Mm-hmm.
But in 1969, I moved to Nashville, Tennessee.
Oh.
And the summer of 69, I was a camp nurse in Vermont, which was a great experience. And we had some adventures there as mm-hmm. well.
Camp nurse, I'm assuming you mean like summer camp.
Yeah.
Gotcha, okay.
Summer camp. And we were, I had a friend, and we both decided we were going to go to Vanderbilt. And she was going to a doctoral program, and I was going to teach. And so before we went, we'd be camp nurses.
Mm-hmm.
So we called up this camp that had advertised in the American Journal of Nursing and talked to him on the phone. And he said, well, you all sound just like the nurses we'd like, so you're hired if your references check out. Of course, they did.
Mm-hmm.
And previously, they had two nurses from Florida that wore white uniforms and were very kind of formal.
Mm-hmm.
And we asked him if we had to wear uniforms, and he said we could wear whatever we wanted to. So we went up there with two dogs. And I think we took one uniform each, but we didn't intend to wear them unless he made us. And so we wore shorts and whatever everybody else wore. And we got that camp organized. When the campers came through, we checked their health records, and we noted all the ones that had allergies or mm-hmm. other problems. We had one diabetic. And, you know, he said it was the first summer they hadn't had anybody hospitalized. But we also had an outbreak of food poisoning. And so we took care of about 120 kids from time to time. We kept the sickest ones in the infirmary, and we organized the counselors to check on them every hour and to take fluids. And if anybody mm-hmm. started running a temperature, we'd move them up to the infirmary. So we got over that. And about 4 weeks later, we had the same thing again, because the chlorinator had broken and it was pouring raw sewage into the lake, and half these kids got sick again. So
because they were swimming in the lake, I assume.
Yeah, and well, drinking the water, because there was a seal that broke between the lake water and the drinking water, and it was contaminating it. And mm. so if you drank water, you got sick. And I didn't drink much water, so I didn't get sick. But CDC was up there checking us out. And we still didn't have any children hospitalized, but several folks mm. around the lake did have to take mm-hmm. their kids to the hospital.
Mm, that's amazing.
So that was a really nice experience.
And where in Vermont was this?
Ely, which was on Lake Fairfield. And it was right on the border between Vermont and Connecticut. A beautiful area.
How do you spell Ely?
E-L-Y.
Oh, Okay.
And when we finished camp, we drove down to Nashville, Tennessee, and bought a house and moved in. Started working. I was teaching at Vanderbilt.
Was that the first time you'd actually taught? Or
well, I taught the last year I was at Florida.
Okay. And did you enjoy teaching?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did it from about 1967 until 2006.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. No, 2005. Mm-hmm. I retired December the 31st of 2005. Mm-hmm.
Well, I know eventually you joined the Air Force Reserve.
I did.
How did that come about?
Well, when I was in Florida, I had a friend who was in the reserves, and she said we should check it out. So this friend that I was going to go to Tennessee with, we decided to look into it. And so we called the recruiter and got all that stuff done. And before we left Gainesville, we had gone to Moody Air Force Base, which is in South Georgia, and had a physical, gotten all the scoop. And then when we got to Nashville, they had a hospital, a medical unit mm-hmm. there, and it was at the Air Force Base that was in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. But the commander was the chairman of the OBGYN department at Vanderbilt. And they had about, six nurses in the unit, but they only had one before we got on board, so we added two more. And then there were 100 people in this unit. And shortly after we got accepted, which my commission, I was sworn in on April the 29th, 1970, they closed the base at Murfreesboro, and our unit was then training at the VA hospital in Nashville, which is right across the street from the Vanderbilt University Hospital, and the medical students and the physicians mm-hmm. have practices in both places. And so then, that lasted about a year, and Richard Nixon, closed down that unit. And so I was inactive for about a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
I signed up for an individual mobilization augmentee program, and they had us, another friend that was on the faculty was also in the reserves. And so we were assigned to some unit, I forget, but to train at Little Rock Air Force Base.
Mm-hmm.
And so one weekend on Friday afternoon, we left Nashville and drove to Little Rock, stopped in Memphis and had dinner. It was raining like cats and dogs. We got there very late in the evening, after 10. Worked all day Saturday and all day Sunday at Little Rock Hospital. Got in the car and drove back to Nashville, which is about an 8-hour drive. And on the way into town, we said, well, we ain't doing that again. And so we went inactive. And that lasted until 1974, when somebody told me that the AirVac unit in the Tennessee Air National Guard had some vacancies. And so I went out there and checked that out. And at the time, they had room for about 11 nurses, and I was number 9. And so from 1974 until, 74 until 84, I was in the Tennessee Air National Guard and flew AirVac. Our mission was to evacuate wounded from close to the enemy lines, just behind the lines. And so we flew on C-130s, and we practiced hot loading. We would get the patients ready in a mobile air staging facility,
mm-hmm.
and then load them up on the airplane, and we could load a patient every 30 seconds.
Mm-hmm. And you were obligated to to go active every year for certain...
2 weeks.
2 weeks.
Right.
Usually in the summertime, I think.
Right. One weekend a month, mm-hmm. and 2 weeks in sometime during the year. Mm-hmm. Usually it was in the summer. And then in the flying squadron, we had to fly at least 24 hours a year. But we were a lot, we could fly 48, mm-hmm. and most of us flew 48.
Do you ever think about going full-time with the military?
No, because I liked what I was doing, teaching. And I also would get annoyed with the military because it was a lot of hurrying up and waiting.
Mm-hmm.
And I figured I'd be court-martialed pretty quickly if they had me there full-time. Patience is not one of my better characteristics.
Now, you never went overseas, I assume, did you?
No. With AirVac, we flew around a lot, so I got to the Azores a couple of mm-hmm. times, and we went to Newfoundland, and we went to a lot of the bases in the West, mm-hmm. and several times I flew active duty AirVac for 2 weeks at a time, mm-hmm. and we would fly 12 hours a day. Mm-hmm. I mean, we'd be on the airplane 12 hours. We were only in the air about 8.
Mm-hmm.
But we'd go all over the country taking people various places.
Mm-hmm. Well, what kind of training did they give you so you could do all this?
For the original hospital unit, I didn't have to do anything. They just swore me in.
Mm-hmm. So no basic training, nothing like that?
I didn't do any of that,
oh,
no.
Okay.
Now, after I got in, and I went in as a captain because I went in when I had a master's degree.
Mm-hmm.
After that, I think most people do have to go to some sort of officer training school, mm-hmm. which is at least a week or two. And in 1975, I went to 6 weeks of flight training. That was down at Brooks Air Force Base in San Antonio.
Mm-hmm.
And we had 6 weeks of that, and lots of academics, and some simulated stuff, and then one airplane flight. It was not until I got into the Guard, I figured out I got airsick. And so I would have to lie on my physicals every year that said, "Do you get airsick?" And I'd say no, and everybody in the unit knew. We laughed about whether it was a one bag or a two bag trip. That was a six sack, not my luggage.
Mm. I'm assuming you didn't have to take any kind of physical either in order to be commissioned a captain at that point, because they just swore
any kind
you,
of a physical,
right?
Or physical training.
Well, yes, physical training. I'm sorry. Yeah.
To get in, I didn't have to do any physical training. But annually, we had to, be able to run a mile in mm-hmm. So many seconds or mm-hmm. minutes and, this and that and the other
mm-hmm.
thing. So
right.
we did have to stay in shape.
Right.
And they, of course, we had a flying physical every year. And every 3 years, we had to go to the altitude chamber.
Mm-hmm.
And, it was pretty rigorous. I stayed in shape.
What did your friends and family think about you joining the Tennessee National Air Guard?
Well, I think they probably thought it was terrible, but I didn't ask them. I just told them, which is the way I usually do
mm-hmm.
things. I think they liked it by the end. And, when I first got into the military, I was bored. And every month I'd say, well, I don't know if I want to do this. And then my paycheck would come. And as small as it was money that I didn't have before.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, well, I'll stay another month.
Mm-hmm.
And when it got to be 10 years, I knew I was there for 20.
Mm-hmm.
And then I ended up staying 30
mm-hmm.
because I made full colonel before
right.
I was in 20 years. And, they don't kick you out till you're 60.
Mm-hmm. You had the option to leave. I mean, you could have left 1 month after.
I could have left
any time. Okay, so you
right.
you were not tied down to a certain length of time.
No. I mean, I signed up for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, I never had to sign up for anything again. But you could leave anytime you wanted.
Mm-hmm.
It was not like during the when the men were drafted, they had to stay.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Completely different. Right. Yeah. Well, where were some of the places that you were stationed when you went around during your active duty days?
Well, in the Guard, we did some training at in Buffalo, New York, 2 weeks. We did some at Hanscom Air Force Base in just outside of Boston. And in all of these things, usually we'd have some sessions, days when we would set up mobile air staging facilities and have airplanes flying in and out and load patients and treat them in the air and stuff like that. A lot of our stuff was simulated.
That's just nasty with some of the simulated.
Simulated. And sometimes we could do our active duty. Well, we had to be on active duty if we went out of the country. So on the Azores trips, and I did a couple of those, we had to be on active duty. And sometimes it could be extra or it could be part of your 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us, if we got extra days, we just got extra pay.
Mm-hmm.
And on the one of the Azores trips, it was in 1980, I think, when the weekend of the Iranian hostage rescue attempt, and had those raids succeeded, we probably would have then flown to Germany and brought back some of the hostages. But as it was, we flew back with a plane load of dependents, crying babies and, tired mothers and people like that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what we were there for, so
mm-hmm. Right.
So we did it.
Right. Well, it sounded like you enjoyed your work for the most part.
I did. I loved it.
Yeah,
now, one of your questions here says what... did you ever have any fearful experiences?
Mm-hmm.
And some of them were on airplanes. When we'd have to land on three engines and, little things like that. We also, on our Wednesday night sessions would do a bunch of touch and goes, which they weren't supposed to do with passengers on board. But, we were just the flight crew back there taking care of simulated patients. So they we did it. And it wasn't always calm.
Now, I'd never heard the term Wednesday night sessions before.
We had to fly 48 or 24 times
mm-hmm.
a year,
mm-hmm.
and they would fly every Wednesday night, and then some weekends. So we always had one weekend trip a month. So
mm-hmm.
usually, the 10 years I was in the Guard, I was usually doing something like that 2 weekends a month,
mm-hmm.
one for our regular training and one for flying.
Mm-hmm.
And then I flew several other Wednesday nights.
Mm-hmm.
Some people went to prayer meeting. We went to the base and flew.
Oh, gosh. Well, I'm assuming that you worked with both men and women in most of the time. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes. So do you think you were treated equally the majority of the time?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there was always some derogatory stuff going on with the men. And there were some women that slept around. But one of the things that we did, they always, in our flight suits, there are those green bags that look terrible
mm-hmm.
on everybody. And so the guys were always talking about how we looked, and they would rate us. And so one Saturday we decided that we were going to rate the flight crew when they got on the airplane Sunday morning. And of course we told them we were going to do that, and we had these placards, and that was when the movie 10 was out.
Yes.
And so we had these placards, and we were going to hold them up. We were all sitting on the side where they had to climb on board. All of them got on with their flight jackets tied around their waist. So we, you know, would have trouble waiting, and we rated them anyway. They were so embarrassed, and we said, well, now you know how it feels. The other thing is, and this is kind of ugly, but they had a rule that whoever had to use the porta potty first had to empty it. And of course, the men could use the relief tube that was in the back, and the curtain and the porta potty were on a stand back there by the relief tube. And so we decided to avoid all that. We learned how to empty our bladders in a cup and pour it down the relief tube. And so the only thing in the porta potty was whoever had a bad GI system. And that made them a little bit distressed, because we didn't eat the garbage they ate. We didn't have any of those problems. We had a lot of fun, but there was a lot of give and take.
Would you recall what the hardest thing you ever had to do while you were with the guard? And this could be physically or emotionally.
Well, we had a couple of plane crashes.
Oh my gosh.
And so we lost some of our friends.
These were serious plane crashes.
Huh?
These were serious plane crashes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, one of them, there were four people on board, so four people died. It was just the flight crew and the loadmaster, you know, the pilot, co-pilot, the navigator, and the loadmaster. But they were our friends.
Mm-hmm.
And then another one, you know, a couple people survived from that one. There were, I think, six people on that one. And they did something on landing, and the plane flipped over and caught on fire. So I think dealing with that and going to the funerals and all that stuff was probably the hardest. None of it was really hard. The altitude chamber was not pleasant. You know, they took you up to altitude, and
that was a simulation, right? I've never been in altitude chamber, but that's all simulated.
Well, no, this is real.
Oh, okay.
I mean, they have this chamber, and they have one at Brooks, and they have one at Wright-Patterson, and we'd go to one place or the other every 3 years. And, you know, they'd take you up to altitude, and then they'd make you take off your oxygen mask and follow their commands. And what you're trying to do is recognize your symptoms of hypoxia, because if you're at altitude in an airplane and the oxygen system screws up, you need to be able to get on supplemental oxygen so that you can save the aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And if you remember Payne Stewart's airplane, that's what happened with that. You know, they all got hypoxic up there and didn't recognize it, and they flew till they ran out of gas, and then they hit the ground. And so we'd do that, and then they did a rapid decompression. Do you know what that is?
I do not.
Well, if the door blew off an airplane and you were at 30,000 feet, you know, then it would be a rapid decompression.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would do that to us, and we had to equalize the pressure in our ears and do that so that you didn't rupture an eardrum.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to do all this stuff pretty quickly. So the training was real. And it was kind of scary. I was always nervous doing that, but I managed.
Mm-hmm. Now, the other people in your unit, they were, I assume, other nurses, of course, and doctors. Were there other people?
In the guard?
Yes.
In the flying unit, we eventually had, during the buildup, and I forget exactly what years these started, but probably the early 80s, we doubled the size of our unit. And so we went from 11 or 12 nurses to 26. And then we had about 75 medical technicians,
mm-hmm.
and then some administrative support people. So in our medical evacuation unit, we didn't have any doctors. But on the base, at the guard base, they had a bunch of doctors
mm-hmm.
that were responsible for flight physicals and physicals for everybody in the unit and all that kind of stuff, and some dentists and all that kind of stuff. This was the 118th Airlift Wing of the Tennessee National Guard, and we were the 118th Aeromedical Evacuation Squadron. There are only two medical Air-Vac squadrons in the country, and the other one's at Van Nuys Air Force Base.
It's called Van Nuys.
V-A-N-N-U-I-S.
That's in California, isn't it?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. It's V-A-N capital N-U-I-S.
That's right, okay.
Uh-huh.
Well, did you ever consider yourself to be any kind of physical danger while with the Guard?
Only, you know, when the airplanes were not functioning on all engines.
That would be kind of scary.
Right.
Yeah. Would you ever any embarrassing moments that you can recall, or humorous moments?
Any embarrassing or humorous? Mm-hmm. We had lots of fun. And I'm sure I was embarrassed plenty of times, but I don't remember anything specific.
Okay. Did anything unusual ever happen on any of these flights or while you were on duty?
Nothing that I could note right now, but, you know, again, we had, you know, lots of fun.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm assuming when you went out for 2 weeks, you were not in military mode 24 hours a day. So what did you do in your spare time while you were out?
Well, when we flew somewhere, our work was on the airplane. And mm-hmm. so when we hit the ground, we had free time.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on where we were, you know, if we were in El Paso, Texas, we usually went to Mexico on Saturday and shopped and bargained and drank a little tequila and stuff mm-hmm. like that. And if we were in Salt Lake City, Utah, we went skiing. If we were in Miami, Florida, we might have gone to the Everglades or, you know, done something like that. But the one time I remember, we were at Homestead Air Force Base. I wrote a third of my dissertation down there, and I got a good start on it, so I was able to get it finished after that.
But it sounded like you went to a lot of interesting places during those years. Just wonderful.
We did. Yeah, and when we went to the Azores, we stopped one night in Bermuda,
mm-hmm.
and so we rode all over the island. And stopped a number of places and ate scones and talked all the way back on the bus about what scones might be good for, because we thought they were hard little rocks of things. We thought of a bunch of things you could use scones for.
From that period of time, do you have any particularly heroes or heroines that stick out in your mind? And that could be anybody.
Not particularly. I was very impressed with the nurses that I flew with on active duty.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, I was kind of scared of them. They outranked me a bit, but, you know, they were hard-nosed about the safety issues
mm-hmm.
and the kinds of things that you needed to do in emergencies.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I attempted to perform pretty well, and I think I did, but I was impressed by them and also kind of scared of them.
Mm-hmm. And these were regular?
These were active duty people.
Active duty.
Right.
Army, Air Force?
Air Force.
Air Force,
yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
On Air-Vac, it's always Air Force.
Oh, Air Force, mm-hmm. okay. Well, do you consider yourself to be an independent person?
Yes.
Okay. And do you think, have you always been that way, or do you think being in the military for 30 years, I think you said, or close to it, helped make you that way?
Well, probably the military and all of my experiences and my education
mm-hmm.
have moved me from an insecure teenager
mm-hmm.
to a pretty secure adult. And, you know, I've had responsible jobs from the time I was a teenager. I was a lifeguard for 3 years every summer from 16 to the time I went to nursing school. You know, when I was the camp nurse, we also substituted as instructors in tennis and water skiing, and we accompanied the campers on trips and other outings, so we were the lifeguards. And, you know, I've always been pretty responsible. And so, you know, at 24, I had a supervisory position in mm-hmm. nursing.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always done stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, what kind of impact do you think the military had on your life?
Well, of course, I did it for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
So it was my second job most of my career. And occasionally I'd have third jobs, but always I had a second job
mm-hmm.
with the military. And so I would have to keep up with my educational courses that the military had to have. You know, I took air war. So, you know, with my second job, I always had things to do. And usually I had responsible positions. Like in the Guard, I was a flight instructor
mm-hmm.
and a flight examiner, and I was the educational coordinator for the unit most of the 10 years I was there. So I had to organize all the training sessions. And in 1984, I moved to Atlanta, Georgia, and took a position at Emory University. And so I had to find another military position.
Mm-hmm.
And I commuted back to Nashville once or twice because I didn't want to mess up my continuation or my points.
Mm-hmm.
And then I interviewed with the commander of a new unit that was going to start at Robins Air Force Base. And this was the Detachment 3 of the 13th Contingency Hospital. And so I went to interview with him on the way out of town to go to Nashville for my guard duty. And we talked for an hour or so. And I said, well, when are you going to make your decision about, you know, whether or not I can join the unit? And I was interviewing for the chief nurse position. Oh, and he said, I've already made it. You can have it if you want it. I said, oh, okay. And so he told me he'd already hired a first sergeant, so I would have to interview with him. And of course, the first sergeant told me that he was a package deal with his fiance. And so the four of us basically started this unit, and we recruited 100 people mm-hmm. in about 6 months. And we had 26 nurses. All of them had bachelor's degrees.
Mm-hmm.
It was a great experience, and I did that until 1997.
Mm-hmm.
No, 87, not 97. And then I accepted a mobilization augmentee position at Andrews Air Force Base with the command nurse. And I did that from 87 until 92, I think. And then I did a lateral arabesque to, that was systems command, to material command at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And I was with the command nurse there until 97, I think. And then I went to the Pentagon as IMA to the chief nurse for REM, which is the reserve emergency something or other. I forget what REM stands for. And I did that until I retired.
So
and with the mobilization positions, you only did 2 weeks a year
mm-hmm.
and 3 days a quarter. And the big change was that I went from weekend duty to I had to do them. Do those days during the week.
Mm-hmm.
So that got harder.
So some of these things you were doing long distance because you were living here in Greensboro during some of that time.
Well, I had to travel to those places to do it.
Yeah. Uh-huh. That must have been kind of tough.
Not usually, except when there were big snowstorms. Then sometimes getting home was a problem.
I can imagine. Mm-hmm. So, did you drive to Andrews Air Force Base from Greensboro? Oh
my God. 5.5 hours.
That's a long. You couldn't have driven to Wright Air Force Base.
I did.
Oh my Lord.
I didn't want to be up there without my car, especially for the 2 weeks.
Well, that's true.
Right.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
And one time, in 1993, I got stuck in Knoxville, Tennessee for 3 days during that big blizzard.
Mm-hmm.
And I very carefully stopped at a motel with a restaurant. The restaurant never opened after Friday night, and so Saturday night we had a ham sandwich from the Red Cross, and Sunday the grocery store a mile up the road opened, and I got some carrots and yogurt, and Monday I managed to get up the road another 80 miles and stopped at a pizza place.
Mm.
Got home on Tuesday.
Oh my goodness. Well, if you had to do it over again, would you join the military and do the same sort of thing?
Well, I think I would. Yeah. I had a really good time. Yes. And, you know, I was not really committed until after 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was in for 20. And, you know, I made colonel before that. And
mm-hmm.
I said, well, I might as well stay
mm-hmm.
as long as I'm enjoying it.
Mm-hmm.
And at age 60, of course, you get some retirement.
Mm-hmm.
So... you know, it's helped out financially.
Well, how do you feel about women being in combat positions these days?
Well, I think if women are going to be in the military, they need to be available for whatever the military needs them for.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm sorry, anybody has to be in combat. And I certainly wouldn't want to be in combat, but I think we need to keep ourselves in a position where we can do all the jobs that we're trained for.
Now, how do you feel about, of course, in the last couple of years, we've had a lot of reserve units activated and that sort of thing, which we never had probably in your day. How do you feel about that situation?
Well, I think it's riskier these days to get in the reserves.
Yes.
And that might have colored my willingness to do some of these things.
Mm-hmm.
But I managed to not get called up until Desert Storm, and I did get activated for that. I did. I was called one Friday night about 10 o'clock, and I had a week to get to Eglin Air Force Base in Florida. And, I mean, I was in a contingent of about 200 people that showed up that week.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were responsible for making sure everybody was trained. And most of these people were nurses, and some of them were medical technicians,
mm-hmm.
and some of them were physicians. But we had to get them all up to snuff, and I was assigned as the assistant to the chief nurse. And so, you know, we had to, our mission was to double the size of the hospital, and so we had to make plans for moving out all the extraneous office equipment so that we could move beds into spaces to put patients. And as it turned out, we only got 50 patients from the war. Our most famous one was Wanda Cornum, who was the Army flight surgeon. Her husband was a flight surgeon in the Air Force and stationed at our place. So after they released her, she was in that helicopter crash
mm-hmm.
and captured. After they released her, they flew her to Eglin, and we had to re-break her arms to fix them.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sad.
Mm. And so how long were you activated at that point?
62 days.
Oh.
62 days.
And that was in 91, I guess, mm-hmm. is that right now?
That was in 91, February.
And where were you working at that point?
Assigned before
no.
then?
No, were you already retired by that time?
I retired in 2000.
Oh, 2000, okay. So what? So what were you doing on your regular job?
I was teaching at Vanderbilt.
Okay.
I mean at UNCG.
UNCG.
Well, I was dean at UNCG from 1985 to 90.
Right. Okay.
And in the fall of 90, I was on leave of absence, and I came back and I taught a year, and then I was activated in January of 91.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway,
62 days is a long time to be away. That's a good long time.
Somebody else had to take my teaching slot, but it all worked out.
Mm-hmm. And so you spent the entire time at Eglin?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Our most exciting thing there was Dan Quayle was coming to visit, so mm-hmm. we had to go through the White House pre-visit mm-hmm. work and plot out what would happen if an accident happened or somebody shot him or any of those things.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, if he gets shot in the head, you need to take him to Pensacola. You don't want to come here, because we didn't have any neurosurgeons. But I worked with the Secret Service on doing all
stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And was he just on a regular fact-finding visit, or
Was
he on a regular fact-finding visit, or what was he doing at your base?
Making a speech.
Oh.
And I didn't get to hear that, but you know, they were, I think, just politicking.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you were quite involved with the Association of Air National Guard Nurses at one time.
Yes.
President, Vice President, Program Committee. Was that a positive experience?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And every year we met at AMSIS, the Association for Military Surgeons of the United States, and they would meet every fall somewhere, usually in November, in San Antonio or Washington or Anaheim. Those are about the only three places that could accommodate the number of
mm-hmm.
people that were there. And so we were trying to improve the rank structure for nurses in the Guard. And in most of the Guard units, a lieutenant colonel is the highest rank you can get as a nurse. And colonel was the highest rank you could get nationally as a nurse in the Guard
mm-hmm.
anywhere. And so we now have a general's position, and there probably are some colonels, but still mostly in the Guard. There are only a few colonels, and they're commanders of units,
mm-hmm.
and the rest are lieutenant colonels. And, so, which, and that's one of the major reasons that I switched from the Guard to the reserves, is because so I could get rank.
Mm-hmm.
And I switched in 84, and I was promoted in 87.
Now, you came to UNCG, was I think, in 1985, is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, and you came from Atlanta.
From Emory.
From Emory, right,
mm-hmm.
yeah. Well, can you tell me something about your time at UNCG? What was it like in the mid-80s?
Well, when I came to the School of Nursing in 85, they had just gotten two computers. We did not have computers in the School of Nursing. The operating budget was $39,000 a year for the whole school. And by the time I stepped out of the deanship, it was only up to 42. So it's improved significantly since then. But I think the School of Nursing was sort of a stepchild. And of course, I followed a dean who'd been there since the founding.
Dean Lewis, yeah.
Right. And it turned out to be sort of an interim position.
Mm-hmm.
I was only there 5 years.
Mm-hmm. What was the school like in those days? I'm talking about the whole university. Of course, it was much smaller than it is today, I assume.
Well, the deans were a pretty close-knit group. We didn't have a provost. That position was called vice chancellor.
Mm-hmm.
Fred Drake was the financial vice president. And of course, he died some years later of throat cancer, but he was adamant about all of the parking being open. So there were no designated spaces for anybody. Even if you had to go out half the day and come back, you had to look for a parking space. And so some of the philosophy seemed kind of tight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't very flexible.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were there during Chancellor Moran's tenure, right?
Yes.
What was he like, do you recall?
Well, I thought he was kind of stiff.
Did he get along with the faculty for the most part, do you recall?
He wasn't very accessible.
Mm-hmm. And I can't remember, there was a vice chancellor of academic affairs named Elizabeth Zinser. Was she there when you were there?
She was.
I can't remember. And there was a big controversy about her leaving, going to Gallaudet, and coming back, and there was just all kinds of things.
Yeah, I was there through that.
How did the School of Nursing change during your tenure, do you recall?
Well, for the first time, we were able to establish some scholarships.
Oh, great.
And we didn't have any scholarships before. And I was pretty good at raising money. We started a Board of Visitors. Probably some things didn't change, but we sort of got more on a scholarship kind of path,
mm-hmm.
and developed some research grants. We got some of those. We had a director of research for the first time. The size didn't change particularly, but...
How about the caliber of the students?
But they've always been pretty good.
Pretty good, I've always been pretty good students, yeah.
Yeah, I think we had some, we did change the curriculum the second year I was there.
Mm-hmm.
We put in an emphasis on gerontology,
mm-hmm.
because with the way the country was going in terms of aging, we needed to prepare our students for that. We started the anesthesia program, which now is our biggest graduate program. Mm-hmm. And, we started with Baptist first, and that was in 88. And then in 1990, we brought on Raleigh School of Anesthesia. And now we have over 100 students in the graduate program that are anesthesia students, which is the biggest program.
Wow, I did not know that. That's wonderful. You mentioned Baptist, that's Baptist...
Baptist Hospital, Wake Forest.
In Wake Forest,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
And they don't have a nursing program over there. And I think Sandra Ouellet, her name was Marie at the time, but she's since remarried, had talked to Dr. Lewis at some point, and Dr. Lewis sort of thought that nurse anesthetists weren't really nurses. And so that was a dead end for them, so... 6 months after Dean Lewis stepped down, they were back in my office wanting to know if we would consider. And so it took us a year to work out the agreement in the curriculum with the help of some consultants. But we did it, and we started the program in 88. We got a big grant to do it.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. Yeah. Well, I suppose you've sort of been keeping up with what's going on with the School of Nursing. Are there any plans for, in addition to the building, to your knowledge, or anything, expanding physically and that sort of thing?
They've talked about it, but
mm-hmm.
I don't know anything specific.
Mm-hmm.
Since I retired, I really haven't been involved
mm-hmm.
over there. In fact, I think the first time I've been back to the university was when your reception was.
Oh, glad you could make it. It was a real nice reception.
It was. It was very nice.
Yeah. And I'm glad you brought Grace with you.
Well, Grace brought me, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Grace's, Kathy couldn't make it for some reason.
Right.
So Grace, she doesn't like driving over there.
Right.
I said, well, if you can get them to figure out parking, I'll take you over there.
Oh,
I think parking is a major problem over there.
Has been for evermore.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I don't have any other questions. Is there anything you'd like to add to the interview that we haven't covered? We've covered such a variety of things this afternoon.
We did. I don't think so.
Okay. Well, it sounds like you had a great time in the military over those 30 years.
I did. It was a good
experience, yeah.
And it helped me financially,
mm-hmm.
and I made a lot of friends,
mm-hmm.
and I still keep up with some of them.
Right, that's,
mm-hmm.
that's, yeah. That's ways with me. I still keep up with some friends that I met when I was in Charleston,
yeah.
you know, 35 years ago. It's just amazing.
Well, as part of my experience with the Pentagon, we were in Charleston,
mm-hmm.
one weekend to fly on the C-17. So that's our newest airplane, and it's as big as a barn,
mm-hmm.
And it'll hold I don't know how many patients, but it'll also hold tanks.
Mm-hmm.
All the aircraft, well, not when I flew active duty, but you know, the cargo one way and patients the next.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. Oh, gosh. Well, again, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's been wonderful talking to you this afternoon.
I enjoyed it, and I appreciate your interest.
Great. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.